Good morning.
Good.
Okay, welcome everyone. I'm Alina Selganikov. I'm Vice President and Director of Women's Health Policy here at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And on behalf of the foundation, it's my pleasure to welcome you here to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center. I love saying that, the Barbara Jordan Conference Center. Welcome. We are here today to focus our attention on the contraceptive coverage provision of the Affordable Care Act. As many of you know, in the past year, much of the national spotlight has been on how this requirement has been interpreted to affect the religious rights of businesses and other religiously affiliated organizations. This issue is still very much in play, particularly in the courts, and now with regard to nonprofit organizations. Today, however, we wanted to focus our attention on how this particular provision has been implemented by health plans, and how the plan coverage decisions that plans make can affect women's coverage and their contraceptive choices. So as I'm sure you all know, the ACA broke new ground by the first time now requiring private plans to cover evidence-based preventive services. And this includes all the US Preventive Services Task Force recommendations that are highly rated, that's either an A or B recommendation, as well as immunizations that are recommended by the Advisory Committee on immunization practices. In addition, there are 8 new services that were included that were recommended by HRSA. And one of those recommendations was the coverage of all FDA-approved contraceptive services and supplies, and they must be covered and covered without cost sharing. Seems straightforward, right? As we're gonna learn, the interpretation and the implementation of this provision do make a difference. So the contraceptive coverage provision became effective in August of 2012, and while the nation is very sharply divided about Obamacare, and we've heard a lot about that, the polling that's been done around this particular provision shows that about 2/3 of the public actually support and sometimes strongly support this provision. And I would say that it's pretty hard these days to find the public in agreement on, 2/3 of the public on agreement on any particular issue. So I think that really shows some strong support. In addition, we've started to see the results of this provision in terms of savings to women. Several studies have been published that now show that women have fewer out-of-pocket costs for contraceptives. Hopefully, we're going to see a stronger uptick in the use of the most effective methods of contraceptives. Those are the methods that are also the most expensive. And in, you know, our goal is to ultimately see a drop in the unintended pregnancy rate. What we wanted to learn when we started this project is how this particular provision is being implemented by the plans. There have been several news articles that have been reported in the past year or so that say that some women are experiencing some difficulties in getting no-cost coverage for their contraceptives. But we wanted to more systematically review how this provision is being operationalized by the plans. So today, first, my colleague, Lori Sobel, who was the lead author on the study, is going to present the key findings. And I do want to acknowledge publicly our co-authors from the Lewin Group, where are you? In the back, Jennifer Weens, Kim Sung Hawk, and Linda Shields, who are with us in person. They, along with Lori and Nisha Karani, who's also here, on the Kaiser staff, we slogged through a lot of insurance documents. As an aside, we spent the better part of the year working on this project, and this today was the first time that we actually met in person, so thank you. After Lori presents the finding, we're gonna have a panel discussion with 3 experts that have really very different real-world perspectives on this issue. We're lucky to have with us today Dr. Edward Anselm, who is the Consultant Medical Director for Health Republic Insurance of New Jersey. He also has served as the Chief Medical Officer of several health plans, including HIP Health Plan and Fidelis Care of New York. Everyone's full bio is available in your packets. Next to him is Dr. Peggy Ye, who is going to help us understand the coverage issues and how they're playing out on the front lines of contraceptive care. Yet is an obstetrician gynecologist in clinical practice at the MedStar Washington Hospital Center. And to her left is Gretchen Borschelt. She is the Vice President for Health and Reproductive Rights at the National Women's Law Center. At the center, Gretchen oversees the center's advocacy, policy, and education strategies on health and reproductive health. For several years now, the National Women's Law Center has also been operating a hotline for women to assist them when they experience difficulties in accessing preventive services under the ACA. So Gretchen's also going to be able to share with us some of the experiences that women have faced. After the discussion, we'll have open questions from the audience. So I'm sure to leave some time for questions. We have a lot of experts in the audience as well, and I want you to have the opportunity to also contribute. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Lori.
Thank you, Alina. Good morning, everyone. Wow, a lively crowd. I wasn't expecting that. I'm really excited to be with you today to share our findings about how carriers are implementing the contraceptive coverage requirement. I'm going to start with reviewing the provision and then talk about our study and our methodology and then get into the nitty-gritty of our findings. So as Alina just mentioned, and as I'm sure all of you know, the ACA does require coverage of the full range of FDA-approved contraceptive methods without cost-sharing for women. So while this requirement seems straightforward, as Alina mentioned, there has been quite a few media reports of women not being able to access the contraceptive method of their choice without cost-sharing. So let's take a look at why that might be. So when you look at this provision and you break it down, you have to first look and say, what are the FDA-approved methods of contraception? So the FDA has a few different places on their website where they list contraceptive methods. On this screenshot that I have here, they've broken it down into five different categories, where different methods fall into those categories. So the categories are barrier methods, hormonal methods, emergency contraception, implanted devices, and permanent methods. And as we all know, there's overlap between those different categories. So for example, some IUDs are hormonal, and some emergency contraception is hormonal, while an IUD is also an emergency contraception, the copper IUD. If we look at this next screen, which I'm sure you can see very clearly, this is a FDA poster where they list 19 different methods of contraception for women. This makes it a little bit easier to see, but many of these methods we included in our study, and they list everything from sterilization to emergency contraception on this site. So the FDA has different places where they list what is considered an approved FDA method of contraception for women. Next, which is really what the heart of our study is about, is that plans are allowed to use reasonable medical management for any preventative service, including contraception, when the recommendation or guideline for that preventative service does not specify the frequency, method, treatment, or setting for that specific guideline. So what is reasonable medical management? It's a new term, and it wasn't defined in the regulation or the guidelines. So we're left looking at medical management and then trying to wonder what the word reasonable in front of it might mean. So we all know what medical management is. We've all experienced it as consumers. When a health plan tries to steer us towards lower cost drugs or services, and examples of medical management include tiering. So you have a formulary where usually the lower cost drugs are on the lower tiers. We're told that generics are preferred over brand names for the most part. There's step therapy, where a consumer must try a certain drug or device before having access to a different drug or device and try the first one and have it not work for them. Sometimes that's called fail first. Prior authorization, which requires the clinician to submit evidence of medical necessity for a particular drug or device. And then, of course, limits on quantity or supply. So this is really the heart of what we are trying to figure out, is how plans are applying reasonable medical management to the contraceptive coverage provision under the ACA. So here's a little bit about our study and what we were trying to do. We chose five states with a mixture of health insurance marketplaces. So we chose California, Georgia, Michigan, New Jersey, and Texas. We then created a master list of all of the health insurance carriers in that state. From that, we created a list of 24 carriers, many of which operate in more than one state. We invited those 24 carriers to participate in our study. 9 of them agreed to be interviewed, and then we did document review for an additional 11 plans. So the total number of carriers in our study are 20 different carriers. They represent 200 different lines of business across the country, and most of the largest health insurance carriers in the country are included in the study. So this is the list of the methods that we include, and you'll notice the oral contraceptive pill is not included. We tried to start going down that path and just realized we would never finish if we included the oral contraceptive pills. But we do include the vaginal ring, the patch, injections, implants, hormonal IUDs, the copper IUD, emergency contraception, both the progesterone-based pills as well as the ulipristal acetate formulation, as well as sterilization. We also asked plans about related issues to contraceptive coverage. So this is well woman visits, the process for waiving coverage. So if a woman needs something that's not normally covered, what's the process for waiving those limitations, as well as the process for handling religious accommodations. And I'll talk more about each of those when we get to those slides. So now we're going to get into the findings. Before I go through the actual findings for the NuvaRing, I'm going to use this slide to explain, because the next few slides are going to have the same format, what each of these symbols mean, and just give a few caveats of not to do math on these slides. A plan is covering a particular method. The dollar sign means that they're charging cost sharing. The caution sign means that there's step therapy or prior authorization. And the X means that it's not covered. In the report that you have, we've noted where a plan charges cost sharing and requires step therapy or prior authorization. For ease of this presentation, I've separated them out. So if a plan charges cost sharing and does step therapy, they're going to be counted twice in these slides. And then also just to note, this information was just really, really difficult to get. So you're going to see on a lot of these slides, there's unknowns for some carriers. And so if you're trying to do the math to get to 20, you're not going to get there. So don't try. So let's start with the NuvaRing. This slide shows our findings for the NuvaRing. The vaginal ring only comes in the form of the NuvaRing. There is no generic. And it's a hormonal contraceptive that comes in the form of a small, flexible ring that's inserted vaginally by a woman once every 3 weeks, and then discarded for the fourth week of the month. So this method was the method that was the least likely to be covered by carriers without cost sharing or limitations. 12 of the 20 carriers that we reviewed covered the NuvaRing without limitations or cost sharing. 5 plans only covered the NuvaRing with cost sharing. 3 plans require step therapy or prior authorization, and 1 plan does not cover the NuvaRing. Next, we looked at the patch, which is applied to a woman's skin and is also a hormonal contraceptive. I should note that we looked at the Ortho-Eva and the generic, but the manufacturer of the brand name has discontinued manufacturing, so in the not too distant future, the patch will only come in the generic form. 15 carriers cover at least one type of patch without cost sharing or limitations. 6 of those cover both the generic and the brand name. 9 of those cover one or the other. 3 carriers cover the patch, but only with cost sharing. So women in those plans would only be able to get the patch with cost sharing. Next, we looked at injections. We looked at 3 different products, the Depo Provera, the generic Depo Provera, and the Depo SubQ Provera 104. There's some differences between the Depo Provera and the Depo SubQ Provera 104. First, the dosage is a lot lower for the Depo SubQ Provera 104. It's also a subcutaneous shot, which is a lot less painful than the intramuscular shot that the Depo Provera provides. So, and the Depo Provera and the generic are considered equivalent. So 18 carriers cover one of those without cost sharing, one or both, without cost sharing or any limitations. The Depo SubQ Provera 104 had a lot less coverage. 7 carriers cover it without limitations or cost sharing, 5 carriers cover it with cost sharing, and 6 carriers do not cover it at all. Next, we looked at implants. An implant is a thin plastic hormone-releasing rod that is inserted under the skin of a woman's arm by a healthcare provider. We looked at the Implanon and the Nexplanon. The difference between the two is that the Nexplanon is visible through CT scan, ultrascan, or MRI, and also has a different applicator. Should note that this is part of the category that people refer to as LARCs, long-acting reversible contraceptives, and it's highly effective. The implants actually have the lowest failure rate of all of the FDA-approved contraceptives at just 0.05%. For the Implanon, 11 carriers cover it without limitations or cost sharing. 4 carriers do not cover it at all. The Nexplanon has 10 carriers covering it without limitations or cost sharing. 3 carriers do not cover it at all. So the overall coverage for both implants is that 10 carriers cover both without limitations or cost sharing. 1 carrier covers only one implant with no cost sharing and no limitations. And 1 carrier requires prior authorization for both implants. Notably, 2 carriers do not cover either implant. And here's where we weren't able to get information. We were unable to ascertain coverage for either implant for 4 carriers. So moving on to the IUDs, we're first, this slide shows the results for the hormonal IUDs, and there's also the copper IUDs, which I'll cover as well. There's 2 types of brand names that were available at the time of the study, the Mirena and the Skyla. Since then, the FDA has recently approved a third hormonal IUD, the Lileta, that was approved in February. But again, these are long-acting reversible contraceptives that are highly effective. The Mirena has 13 carriers covering it without limitations or cost sharing. 1 carrier requires prior authorization, but no cost sharing. Skyla has 10 carriers covering it without limitations or cost sharing, and 1 carrier requires prior authorization but no cost sharing, and 3 carriers do not cover the Skyla. So taken together, the 2 hormonal forms of IUD, 10 carriers cover both without limitations or cost sharing, 3 carriers cover only one hormonal IUD, and we were unable to ascertain coverage for 4 carriers. Next, we're looking at the copper IUD. This is the only non-hormonal IUD available. It's under the brand name Paragard. And I should mention that there are no generics for any of the IUDs. They're all brand name. For the Paragard, 14 carriers cover the Paragard with no limitations and no cost sharing. 1 carrier does not cover Paragard. And again, this is the only non-hormonal IUD available. And we were unable to ascertain coverage for 4 carriers. So altogether, for all 3 IUDs, 10 carriers, so half the carriers that we looked at, cover all 3 without limitations or cost sharing. 4 carriers cover only one IUD without limitations or cost sharing, and we were unable to ascertain coverage for 4 carriers. Next, we're looking at the emergency contraceptive pills. We looked at 3 different versions of it. It's the Plan B, which is the progesterone-based pill, and then the generics for Plan B, which are also progesterone-based and considered equivalent to the Plan B, and then the Ella, which has a different formulation. It's the ulipristal acetate formulation. Plan B, 5 carriers cover Plan B without limitations or cost sharing. 10 carriers do not cover it at all. But then you have the generic EC, where almost all the carriers, 19 carriers, cover the generic progesterone-based EC pills without cost sharing or any other limitations. The ELA has a lot less coverage, and it's important to note here that recent studies have suggested that women with BMIs higher than 25 might have better success on ELA than on the progesterone-based EC pills. That the effectiveness for women with BMIs over 35 wanes on either EC, but for many within those BMIs, the ELA is the suggested emergency contraceptive pill. 11 carriers cover ELA without limitations or cost sharing. 6 carriers cover it but charge cost sharing, and 2 carriers do not cover it at all. Finally, the final method that we looked at is sterilization, and this was by far the most difficult method to get any information about, partly because there's 2 pieces to it. It's the procedure and then ancillary services, and also for the plans that we were doing document review, these types of things aren't usually listed within the plan documents, so we had a lot of difficulty getting information on this. So we were able to determine that 10 carriers do cover sterilization without limitations or cost sharing. An additional 3 cover it, but we weren't able to determine the cost sharing, and we were not able to get any information about the coverage for 7 carriers. The ancillary services, which are needed for all sterilizations, this is anesthesia, supplies, follow-up care, 5 carriers specify that coverage is covered without cost sharing, and 1 carrier does not cover these services, and we were not able to ascertain coverage for the rest of the carriers. So that, we've gone through all of the methods that we looked at, and now we're going to look at some of the issues that would affect a woman's ability to actually get the coverage for the method that she needs, given the limitations that she might experience within her plan. So the first thing that we looked at in this realm is the process for waiving coverage limitations. So when the Department of Labor put out the FAQs, they specified that if a woman needs a method that is not covered without cost sharing or has limitations within her plan and it's necessary for her to get it, the plan has to have a process for waiving their normal limitations. So none of the carriers that we reviewed have established a formal waiver process for preventative services. They refer consumers to their usual appeal process, and because of that, it's unclear whether any carrier has established an expedited appeal process that would be timely enough for a woman to get emergency contraceptives that are not covered under the policy. And just to put this in context, you know, ELA costs between $45 and $70. That's a big barrier for many women, and she needs to get it within 5 days of having unprotected sex. So if there's no expedited appeal process, a woman might really be out of luck with regard to emergency contraception. Next, we looked at well woman visits. The HRSA guideline specifies that an annual well woman visit is required. HHS has then specified in the FAQs that if a woman needs more than 1 well woman visit per year in order to get all of her preventative services, that those should be covered without cost sharing. So we ask carriers how they handle this. While none of the carriers have explicit policies that limit the number of well woman visits, and they stated that they would cover all visits for preventative services so that without cost sharing, so that's good news. Also, they cover all visits necessary for contraception and follow-up, so insertion, removal, additional counseling, follow-up on side effects, those are all covered without cost sharing. It's not entirely clear how carriers handle approving additional well woman visits, and we did hear from one carrier that it really depends on how the provider bills it. So if the provider bills it as a preventative service, then it will be covered without cost sharing. And if they don't, then the woman might experience some cost sharing. Finally, we asked the plans that we interviewed, because this is obviously not listed in the plan documents, so this part of it was limited to the plans that we actually talked to, about how they're handling requests from employers that have religious objections to providing the coverage to their employees directly. So just to give some background, I'm sure many of you know, the law does allow nonprofit religiously affiliated employers to request an accommodation so that they don't provide the contraceptive services directly to their employees and their employees' dependents, but rather they have to either self-certify that they have a religious objection and they meet the other qualifications to their insurance company, or they have to let HHS know in writing of their objection. So no one really knows how many nonprofits outside of the ones that are litigating or have asked for an accommodation. And so we asked the carriers, and we found out that the carrier said that only a very small fraction of employers have requested the accommodation. Carriers are also allowed to request an adjustment to their fees under the federally facilitated marketplace if they're a third-party administrator and they've paid for contraceptive coverage for the employees of one of these employers. And none of the carriers are seeking reimbursement through that mechanism. And only one carrier has indicated that it adjusted premiums based on the request for an accommodation. So what we learned, getting this information is really difficult. There was really a lot of good news. Many plans are covering many contraceptive methods without cost sharing, but there is a lot of variation, and not all carriers are covering all methods without limitations. So the choice of plans that a woman makes, so when you're shopping for a plan or you're on a plan, might limit your coverage choices and then ultimately your actual choice, because many of the methods are out of price range for many women. So there's a lot more details in the report if you want to take time later to read that, but I hope this gives us an overview and a good springboard for our panel discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, can you guys turn your mics off? Yeah. Is this working now? Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, Lori. After all the time that we spend kind of going through and figuring out how to categorize everything, you did a fabulous job putting it all together. What I'd like to do now is take some time to get thoughts and experiences from our panelists. The first question I have for all of you is kind of, how does this resonate to kind of your experiences, both kind of in plans and practice and experiences that women are having? Does it surprise you or not? Or do you want to start, Dr. Hansom?
Hi, yes. Well, it doesn't surprise me. First, you mentioned the word variation, and variation is the enemy of quality. But the only way you can find out about a problem is by studying it. So I just want to applaud the effort in starting what I hope is a larger and more detailed and granular narrative around the availability of these services. They're very controversial. I received independent calls from consumers or interested citizens encouraging me not to cover abortion services and suggesting that we not apply certain aspects of the rules that we're trying to implement. So there's a great deal of controversy around this. And I also note that a substantial number of plans were reluctant to be interviewed for this process.
Yes.
And I think that's just a reflection of the inherent controversy, or the perception of the controversy, that many corporations
around the contraception issue.
Yes.
Not so much just cover it. Do you think it would have been easier for us to get this information on, let's say, another issue, like smoking cessation, for example, which isn't it? Would that have been easier, or you think it's around the contraception?
Well, all preventive services are new to
yeah.
health insurance companies,
mm-hmm.
so maybe we should talk about something else other than prevention. Prevention is a great leap forward here in our country under the Affordable Care Act, and only a recent discovery that it should be, you know, fully available. But yes, if you're asking about coverage for bariatric surgery, for example,
yeah.
then, you know, you just pick up the phone, or you can go to a health plan's website and find out what's going on.
Okay, great. Dr. Yeh?
Yes. I think this report really confirms what we're seeing on the ground in the office. I know that before the ACA contraceptive mandate came into play, I would always have to check in with my front desk and look at the insurance and be like, is this going to be covered? Do we need to call the insurance company? Start getting my front office staff on the phone with the insurance company to see if they covered a certain contraceptive option that a patient was thinking about, leave the patient in the room while we're on the phone with the insurance company, see a couple of other patients, and before we went back and talked to her. Now, really, it's made a huge difference. Most of the time, if I see that insurance company, I know that they're going to cover a contraceptive method, and then I can take care of that patient right there instead of sitting my office staff trying to, wait. So I think this really confirms our experience in that the contraceptive mandate is really working well. There are certainly some, small pockets where there are some kind of idiosyncratic methods that really aren't covered for kind of strange reasons that don't necessarily have a great medical basis to. But overall, I think that it's made a great impact.
I will echo that, what you just said. I think we can't underestimate what a huge game changer this is for women. Millions of women with private insurance now are able to choose the method of birth control that's best for them without having to factor cost into the equation. And that it makes a huge difference in their lives, in their health, and in the well-being of their family. So I want to echo how important this benefit is for women across the board. But on the other side, so what your report finds is basically what we know to be true, that there are still some women who are not fully benefiting from this tremendous advance for women's health. Women aren't getting the birth control method covered at all. They're still having to pay cost sharing. The waiver process is not in place in a lot of these plans. And that means for these women, this is not a real benefit for them. And I don't think these are just problems. I don't think these are just barriers. These are violations of the law. These plans that are doing this are violating the ACA. They need to come into compliance. The benefit went into effect in August 2012. Yes, it's new. Yes, it takes some time to implement, but these plans need to come into compliance, and state and federal regulators need to step up enforcement and make sure that the plans are complying with the way they should.
Great. Well, we're going to get into a lot of these issues. I wanted to start with Dr. Anselm. I think for most of us, I have to say, understanding what goes on behind the scenes in plans, it's kind of like a big black box. Especially, we're all fine when what we have is covered, but when the decisions that plans make to deny coverage for something that we feel that we need or our provider feels that we need, and is kind of mysterious. Why it is or it isn't happening. Can you tell us a little bit about the process that plans or the medical directors go through in terms of determining coverage decision?
When you have a new program, a new technology, a new set of services, what's required is the development of a medical coverage policy. The medical coverage policy should define how the health plan approaches it, at least in general terms, so that consumers and physicians can understand what's covered, and most importantly, what's not. Specifically, these coverage guidelines should outline the reasons why something might not be covered, and then go into the details of the coverage techniques that were discussed in the slide. Tiering, of course, is against the law because there's no cost sharing involved. Generics would be preferred because, it makes sense to use something cheaper than more expensive. Step therapy, the fail first in contraception just doesn't resonate for me. the idea that you have to try something, sometimes people don't tolerate a medication and so on. That's another example of failure. But nonetheless, it makes sense. Prior authorization, well, in the case of emergency contraception, that's a critical factor, but even in other instances, there's a hassle factor. And health plans are famous for the hassle factor. It turns out there's a lot of money that could be spent wisely or inefficiently within healthcare, and health plans' medical policies represent efforts to try to do that. And they create processes, either claims operations or prior approval processes that result in the correct outcome in the most efficient manner. And therefore, I'm totally surprised by some of the findings in this paper, because the techniques mentioned therein are not intellectually defensible. All right, at the end of the day, if you want to have a prior authorization process, you should be able to defend it to your colleagues, to your peers, to your regulators, and so on. So it should be sufficiently clear why you're doing something and should result in a defensible denial an overwhelming proportion of the cases. Otherwise, you're just hassling the doctor. So so when you take these considerations into effect and you look at the time available to do things and the value that's inherent in oral contraceptive technologies, it's a commonly used procedure, there's a tremendous cost spread, so you have to sit down and say, do I have the time between now and when I have to file my plan to develop a defensible medical policy that I could implement successfully through my computer claim systems? So the challenge is always to do this on time and to do it correctly. So on the pharmacy side, I took the pathway of expediency and just said, it's all in. I don't have the time to think this through, and I don't think it's defensible. I don't think it's defensible to make these distinctions, even though there are substantial variations in cost. So I didn't think at the end of the day I wanted to be defending this. Secondarily, I didn't want to defend it because this is a subject of great public scrutiny, and who wants that attention? Health plans should want to be friendly towards women because women make the choices in healthcare in terms of which plan to take. Furthermore, we don't want to antagonize our physicians because we need them to participate with our plan. So it's a lot easier to try and set up a process where the answer is yes. So it always amazes me how health plans can come up with the a system that's structured to come up with an answer that's no.
And did this particular provision, I mean, you know, a lot of plans were covering contraceptives before the ACA. They weren't all doing it without cost sharing, and there was no requirement that they do it, but a lot of them were. Did this present special challenges in terms of the implementation?
Well, so the hard part is getting the claim systems right. So it's really easy to say they're all in and they're all zero to your pharmacy benefits manager. That was really easy. The hard part is making certain that when a preventive service is delivered, that it's coded and billed correctly. Now, you can set up your claim system to do so, and that takes a lot of checking and runs amount of detail, but it still requires the physician or the billing manager to set it up correctly.
And can you give us an example of when you think it might be appropriate? I mean, you talked about your own decision-making process, when it might be appropriate for a plan to apply medical management to contraceptives?
Well, I'll give you an example. If someone wanted an inpatient stay in order to implant a device, this is an office-based procedure, and certainly we wouldn't want to authorize an overnight hospital stay to perform a procedure unless there was a really good reason to do so. Right, so that's an example where, yes, we'll take care of this in the outpatient setting without prior approval, but if you want a hospital day, well, then let's talk about it. But there's always and the standard appeal process does hold, and there are appropriate time frames, probably not for all contraceptives, emergency contraceptive, but there are time frames for standard appeals and expedited appeals. Most of the plans that participate in the study are NCQA accredited, and so they do try to get it right, and they are on the hook for trying to get it right. But I agree that anytime there's a barrier to care, there's a delayed service and opportunity to get it wrong.
Okay, great. Dr. Ye, you talked a little bit about some of the changes that you've been seeing in your practice. Have you seen changes in the types of contraceptives that women are using? And, how does that translate day to day for many of your women patients?
Yes, absolutely. So, before the ACA, a lot of methods were available to patients, but particularly the more expensive types, like the long-acting reversible contraceptives, the IUDs and the implants, those tend to be at much higher cost sharing for patients or not covered, or having these stepwise therapies or prior authorizations and that kind of thing. And so really since the ACA, there's a lot of different things that kind of go into the increased demand for long-acting reversible contraceptives, but certainly the accessibility, the cost, and the availability is a big part of it. And that really has, I think, really skyrocketed, you know, for patient demand and the ability for us to place them. The cost sharing, you know, the fact that patients really don't have to pay for it and provide cost sharing is has really significantly increased their interest. That and the ability for us to provide it on the same day at that visit. So a patient comes in for a contraceptive counseling visit. I talked to her about all her options and she wants the IUD. Before, if there's a prior authorization, other types of approval processes, I'd have to send her home and she'd have to come back once all the paperwork was done. Now with the ACA for most insurance plans, I can place it that day without having to, you know, have this hassle of calling the insurance companies and filling out all this paperwork. So I would say that the biggest impact really has been with the LARC methods.
With the LARC methods. And have you experienced any, you were talked a little bit, any difficulties that patients may have experienced? You know, we had documented some barriers and...
Right. I would say luckily, you know, most of the, like I said, the ACA has really been a huge benefit for patients. There are still some patients out there that kind of do fall through the cracks. So we've had some patients who are insured under religious organizations, and so it's not even an accommodation. They are exempt from the contraceptive requirement. And so those patients who maybe want an IUD, you know, those are, can be astronomical. You just have to pay out of pocket. It can be $500, $600 just for the device. And unfortunately, she, you know, she would make too much money to qualify for a lot of the grants that are available for low-cost LARC methods. But has, still has no insurance coverage for it. And then the other one that...
That wasn't a medical management issue. That was the fact that it wasn't covered.
Absolutely.
Because her, because her plan was exempted.
Plan.
It's a different...
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Your report doesn't touch this. The ACA requirement really only applies to private insurances. So patients that are insured under Medicaid or Medicaid expansion are also another pocket of patients that are kind of lost in, you know, that lose this benefit.
That's the next project we're doing.
Yeah. Big one. Another
yes.
big one.
But it does apply to the Medicaid expansion population.
It should apply
Medicaid
to the Medicaid
expansion population.
Expansion population.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, but the
yeah.
regular Medicaid population
regular.
Does not.
Yeah. And Gretchen, in terms of the women who are reaching out to the National Women's Law Center, what have been their particular challenges and
yeah,
how
so
they've been resolved?
The National Women's Law Center has a hotline, a toll-free hotline women can call, cover her. We also have a website and we have an email address. And it's there for women who are having trouble getting their birth control benefit or if women want to tell us how successful they've been getting their benefit and what difference it's made for them. And so we do hear from women every day who are so appreciative to have this benefit. It means that they can finally afford to get the birth control that's the best for them, that's the most effective, which is oftentimes the most expensive, so they can finally get it. They don't have to choose anymore between paying for birth control and paying for activities like groceries. Plan their family so they can further their career and education opportunities. So it really has made a difference for these women in terms of their health, their financial security, their education, their career. As I said, it really is a game changer for women. But we also hear women every day who are having trouble getting the benefit. And we've heard stories from every woman in every state, in the, not every woman, I shouldn't say that. We've heard from women in every state in the country. That would
need
be terrible.
Need a couple of hotline yeah. counselors on
yeah.
that one.
That would take all of our jobs all the time. So these women are spending hours on the phones with their insurance companies trying to figure out what their coverage policy is. It's hard yeah. to figure out, as you said. It's very difficult. And they're spending this time. They're trying to get their birth control covered. It's just they're getting the runaround. They get conflicting information from their insurance company. Some women are told their method just isn't covered at all. Others are told, well, if you want a method without cost sharing, you need to switch methods. And I'm pretty sure we can all agree that your insurance plan should not be the decider of which birth control method you get. But that's basically the box that they're putting women into. And then other women are getting a birth control method covered, like the IUD, but sometimes aren't getting the services that go with it covered. So they're getting a huge bill at the end of that. So there's definitely still problems. We're hearing about them every day. The good news is that women are talking to their insurance companies about the problems. They're appealing, and they've had successes in getting the coverage for the birth control method they need. But I think the important point is it shouldn't always be up to the women to advocate and advocate and advocate, that the plans need to be complying in the first place.
And how much would you say, because another issue that's come up
a lot is around insurance literacy, you know, understanding what your plan covers, what it doesn't cover. Are you in a grandfathered plan? How much is, you know, or that you're in a plan, you know, you have an exemption versus how much of this is actually the plan?
Yeah, so there's a mix of all of those things. I mean, we hear from women who just are like, I hear that there's free birth control. What is that? You know, it's some basic education. Mm-hmm. There are still grandfathered plans, so that's always the first question we ask the women. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we do have to take them through the steps of, okay, there, you know, there's the grandfathering, there's a religious employer exemption, there's accommodation. So there are steps to go through. And certainly the plan information is very confusing. You alluded to how difficult it was. We are doing our own plan review. We just completed. We're going to produce a report in 2 weeks that supports a lot of what you're saying here. And, you know, we have a staff of experts, really, and we had trouble reading these plan documents. So I think that the insurance companies could do a lot to make the information more easily accessible and available for women to understand. But the bottom line still is the information doesn't help much if the plan's just not providing the benefit and not complying with the law. So again, it gets back to plan compliance.
Great. This gets back to the issue of communications. I think a lot of this is, you know, and transparency. Why do you think why is this so difficult for plans to be transparent about this particular issue? It's, as you said, it's very common. I mean, a lot of women are using contraception.
Well, I think the basic issue around health literacy is that whether or not you've been using health insurance for a period of time or whether you're new to the market, as many, many people are, I think the terms, rules, and structures that we put in place are really complicated. We send out thick program documents which are written in legalese and not accessible to individuals. And there's no opportunity to say what does this mean for you and how does this become valuable for you. So even though we provide the information that's in some form on our websites and been sent to their homes, people don't have the time to read a thick document and figure out what part of it is for them. And so I think that's the basic gap, oversimplifying a large issue about not knowing what a deductible is, but not knowing what's covered.
Yeah.
And I have to say, to a certain extent, that the provider community has been inconsistent in working with patients to enhance their literacy around these issues. Their goal is to just try and serve the patients as best that they can. But sometimes there are opportunities missed in the doctor's office. So I think that the more we get feedback on this subject, the more we learn about it, the more we can try to do better. I think it's always going to be imperfect because people are not going to attend to things till it's too late.
And Dr. Ye, I was wondering, you know, you said some plans we just know. How do you know, like, whether something is covered or not? You know, on your website, I saw there's your profile, and then there's, like, the list of, I don't know, it's like 30 plans that you your practice accepts. Like, how do you know?
Well, sadly, it's really kind of through trial and error. So, like I said, since the ACA, we've had, you know, most of our devices and contraception covered. So a lot of times I just prescribe, you know, it's working the way that it should, right? Mm-hmm. I prescribe the patient the method or the device or whatever she wants after we've had that consultation. And then we'll find out in, you know, 2 or 3 months if it doesn't get paid. So it's usually a lot of retrospectively that we find out. Sometimes if there's a concern, so a lot of times, you know, those devices that cost a little bit more, we actually get on the phone if there's some, you know, insurance plan that we don't see very often, just to make sure. So a lot of it is for the devices on our part to kind of make sure that the insurance plan covers it before we place it. On the flip side, things that I give a prescription for, pills, the patch, the ring, you know, I give the patient that prescription. When she takes it to the pharmacy and finds out that it's not covered, that's when we find out. She may or may not call me back and let me know that it's not covered. A lot of times patients may just, you know, say, oh, it's not covered. I didn't really like any of the other options, and then forego that contraception. So a lot of times it is kind of trial and error, unfortunately. Again, things are improving quite a bit so that we aren't relying on that as much. But a lot of times it's either, you know, if it's something that we're unfamiliar with, us calling or the patient calling, or we place it and see.
No, we weren't able to do, we initially were very ambitious and really wanted to do oral contraceptives, and we did kind of go into a big hole and climbed out and said, okay, it's too hard. But I did want to get kind of your thoughts about oral contraceptives, and are there particular challenges there for all three of you, just so we touch on that, because that is still the leading way that women get their contraceptives. Particular issues?
Well, I think specifically with oral contraceptives, you know, because there are so many formulations out there, that part, you know, is really still kind of based on a formulary like we have in the past. And so that is, you know, if a patient wants an oral contraceptive, then I definitely go look on the insurance formulary if I can find it. Sometimes it's integrated into our electronic medical record. But that's when I have to really work on doing the research to be able to find an oral contraceptive on her insurance. Beyond, you said there generally is a wide variety. So if the one that I particularly was recommending for a patient is not on the, it's not covered, there generally is a substitute that I can use. But that in particular, again, is kind of hesitant in terms of what we do in the office, making sure that the one that I prescribe is on the formulary.
Well, I'm always hoping that more transparency around this kind of issue, because finding out in the pharmacy that it's not covered is going to be a big problem for adherence to any medication. And so that's another reason for us to be inclusive of a process that allows all its medications to be covered. The question is, again, what if a patient is already on a drug and you're writing a renewal? You know, why should a health plan create a barrier for that? You see, in other words, I really think that the rationalization for all of the coverage decisions, whether a medical or pharmacy, should be made increasingly transparent, because I hate to see disruptions in care. If I can't get my drug, but you want to change your patient's medication? Well, yes, they're similar, but, you know, it's working, so why not continue? So I really think that, you know, one of the outcomes of this sort of discussion is an enhanced level of transparency around, you know, the medical management rationale for all the things that we do.
And also where it's come up for us through the CoverHer hotline is that we see generic-only policies in plans, and for some oral contraceptives, there is no generic, and so the women need that brand covered, and that's a problem that we've seen, that plans are unwilling to cover it in that instance, which they're supposed to be doing according to the guidance of the birth control benefit.
And finally, you know, one of the things I learned a lot about in this project was the whole issue around how different methods are classified and around medical management. I served on the IOM committee, and, you know, when we made our recommendation on all FDA-approved contraceptive methods, we assumed that it was all the different methods, or at least I'll speak for myself. That's what my understanding was. We did an interview with a medical director at one of the large national plans who said they don't cover the ring because they said it was the same delivery mechanism for the same hormones that are available through oral contraceptives. And the rationale was the same for the patch. And so I was surprised because I didn't perceive that as a medical management issue. He was pretty clear about that. I just kind of wondered your thoughts. I know you do a lot of work on, we talked about the smoking cessation. I think there are a lot of parallels there.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about the kind of the issue around the delivery systems for all of you?
Well, regarding that particular example, the human capacity to rationalize is vast. what you described to me is intellectually indefensible and would not stand appeal. So why have it? Why have it? I think that I think the whole point is just to make these things transparent. When health plans get a lot of feedback that things aren't working, on a local level from consumers, from the press, who now might get interested in this narrative. Well, you know what? They're going to modify. Your study shows is a snapshot at the very beginning of a process, and since that time, I bet a number of them have gotten wiser with the feedback that they've gotten. So I think that we have to think about medical management and reasonable medical management as a process. We all need feedback. And so when the physician sees a large number of appeals on that particular type of case, then he realizes it costs me, $600 a piece to do these appeals.
For the plan.
Yeah. Right. And therefore, why would I want to spend the time and money doing them when I'm going to lose at the end of the day? So I think it's a process, and we just have to embrace the fact that we took a great leap forward historically, and that we're continuing to learn about how to do this better. And I think this report is an important part of that process.
I agree. I found it very, very surprising that they kind of made this distinction that it was, the NuvaRing and the patch are really the same medication as birth control pills, because we all know that it really is not at all. The way that it's delivered just changes all the pharmaceutical properties and the way that the body handles it. Yeah. So I found that incredibly surprising, and I agree, just really indefensible. It just makes no sense medically to us. So, one other thing kind of parallel I noted in the report was a lot of sterilization procedures are covered, and they didn't make any distinction about how the sterilization procedure was done, because one interviewee said that it's up to the physician to kind of decide what the best way is. And I find that really similar. In the end, you're getting hormonal contraception. Does it matter which way, whether you get it by pills or by patch or ring? The method of getting it, it should still be covered. It's kind of a similar thing to me, I think. So, there are also other medications that are available in different formulations, different forms, tablets, patch films, gels. And a lot of those are covered as well. So I really agree that was very surprising. And I am interested in hearing if it'll be reversed with all these appeals.
Yeah. I can't say that it's surprising to us, because we have heard this, and we know some major plans nationwide have these, five categories that they claim are all the methods, and we just strongly disagree that those are the methods. And I think that if you talk to any woman and you say, is taking a pill the same as putting a patch on or putting a ring in your vagina, she will say, no, those are not the same thing. Those are different methods, and each one needs to be covered. So again, I think the plans here are not complying with the law. The good news is that we know in our report we're going to talk about at least one success story that we've heard where they had broken down into the five categories. And when women complained again that they weren't getting coverage of the ring, now the ring's a new category. But the patch is still not. So,
see, I'm wondering how much relates to when Lori presented the FDA slide. And I think that part of the issue is a transitional issue around the Affordable Care Act. None of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations were developed as coverage determinations. They were designed to provide guidance in, primary care clinical practice about what preventive services providers should offer to their patients. Similarly, when the FDA put their information with the five different categories, this was designed to be a consumer information tool, which it sounds like the plans have used and adopted as a decision-making tool in terms of making their coverage policy. And then they have the poster on the other, on another location, which does differentiate and actually differentiates between two different IUDs and so, and two different methods of emergency contraceptives. So I think that there's kind of a lack of clarity and also differences in terms of, when the plans are interpreting them and the way the guidance, and I don't know if the guidance is also very general. I don't know if, I'm sure there are people here in the audience who also have some thoughts about that, but if you want to comment a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I do appreciate, the ACA is a very big law with a lot of requirements, right? And it is going to take some time for everybody to come into compliance with all of them. But I do think this report shows, and the report we're about to release shows, that there are insurance companies that are using what they see as wiggle room or not clarity, lack of clarity in the guidance, to impose some policies that we think are clear violations of the law. And so I think there's a definite role for HHS and the departments to step up, clarify their guidance, make sure it's clear that they are talking about the FDA poster, those unique methods. That's what we mean when we say all methods have to be covered, that plans need to have a waiver in place. They can address more specifically the kinds of problems that your report calls out, I think. And certainly there's a role for state regulators too. They have the primary responsibility for ensuring enforcement of this benefit, and so they can help out with that as well.
Lori, you want to tell a little bit about how California has addressed this?
Sure. So the great state of California has passed a law that's going to go into effect January of 2016. And rather than just saying all FDA-approved methods, the law says all FDA-approved drugs, devices, and other products for women, including all FDA-approved contraceptive drugs, devices, and products available over the counter as prescribed by the enrollee's provider. And so the law, it mimics the federal law, but calls out each of those categories rather than trying to leave up to the imagination what methods are, or up to the confusing differentiation on the FDA website. Then it further says that each plan must cover at least one or more therapeutic equivalents of a contraceptive drug. So if two things are equivalent, like the plan B and the generic, they have a choice if they want to cover just the generic or plan B or both. In that case, though, if for some reason they cover the generic and then the generic isn't available to a woman or she has an adverse reaction to it, they then are required to cover the brand name plan B and then without cost sharing, subject to utilization management. So in that very limited situation where they cover the therapeutic equivalent and they don't cover the other therapeutic equivalent, so plan B and the generic, they can then use some type of utilization management before a woman can get the other therapeutic equivalent. So it really diminishes the scope of when a plan can use any type of utilization management for the coverage, because they have to cover each therapeutic, every drug that doesn't have a therapeutic equivalent. And if they have a therapy equivalent, then they can cover just one of them.
So the differentiation, for example, in California around injections, for example, where you could cover the Depo Provera, but the sub-Q, they're not generic equivalents, so the plans would have to cover
both
methods, whereas in the federal, right now, it would be just one of the methods. So it gets even more granular.
Right, and it also addresses the ring, the patch,
all of
they would all be covered because they're not therapeutic. Right. To be therapeutically equivalent, you have to have the same formulation and the same delivery mechanism.
So I think now what I'd like to do is open it up to the questions to the audience. If you'd like to come, there's microphones that are coming around. If you could introduce yourself and your affiliation, that would be terrific. We're webcasting this, so it would be a lot easier if you speak up, stand up, and speak. Susan.
Hi. Sorry. Susan Wood, George Washington University School of Public Health. Lots and lots of really interesting stuff, and those plan documents, well, it'd be lovely to be able to get all those medical policies, but those are impossible to get. But thank you for the hard work that you did for this. I have a question about whether you looked across all the methods to say how many companies covered all of them or 90% of them, which were the, and then are you willing to name the good guys and the less good guys?
Do you want to take that one?
The plans that we interviewed, we promised confidentiality for, so we haven't named any plans. We can say that most of the large carriers in the country are included in the plans. We have the information about plans and what they're covering, but we didn't want to identify them, so we didn't include in the report how many, like in each plan, what you would be lacking. It was more evenly distributed. I would say that there's only a handful that covered everything without cost sharing or limitations, and most plans had either a limitation or cost sharing for at least one method.
Cindy.
Cindy Pearson, National Women's Health Network. Thank you. As Susan said, you know, it's we all hear the stories, but now you've got some data, and this will help. Regulators could have stepped up before now. Many of us have been talking to them and encouraging, and some of them have sent representatives here. I don't think any will get any exact answers today, but hopefully those representatives will go back and inform their people that pressure is growing on them to step up and fix this problem, and as Gretchen has said so powerfully, get these plans to comply with the law. But one thing that really stands out in my experience, the calls we get, the women we talk to at National Women's Health Network, that didn't show up in your interviews and review of the documents is the denial of the visit for the IUD insertion. Your report implies that at least of the plans you interviewed and reviewed documents, they believe they're covering it. Our experience of talking to women is that's a very, very common area where people get treated unfairly.
I wonder if that's a coding issue.
Yeah. You wanted to comment on that?
I think that this is really about, my experience of that particular technical issue is that it has to be coded correctly in the health plan's system, and then it has to be coded correctly as a preventive service in the doctor's office. And only when both things work will there be zero copayment for the visit. Nonetheless, one can only, in your systems where you have advocacy, one can only encourage the clients to appeal to have a refund, so that they can be appropriately covered. Again, it's just part of the feedback loop that we need to create.
I know I don't have the mic in my hand, so I apologize to the webcast folks, but the stories we hear are of great physicians like Dr. Yee's office.
On the phone with the plan at the time and being told no. So obviously the physician's office is able to describe it appropriately as a prevent as part of a contraceptive visit as preventive care, so it's inside the plan where that necessary coding hasn't happened. But then why do they tell you in the report, Lori, that or in their documents that it is covered, which implies they've got it coded correctly?
My guess is that they think they're covering it and that there hasn't been enough communication. This goes back to the issue of communication with the doctor's office to adequately educate doctors on how it needs to be coded. I mean, I don't know the specifics. I can just tell you what we found in the study, that they think they're covering it.
Yeah, they were pretty clear about what they weren't covering. So we didn't have any reason to believe that they would say that. I mean, you know, they were very open about that.
Just to comment on that, the complexities, I never thought I would have to go back and learn COBOL again, but the complexities of making sure that the things you say to your programmers are translated into operational and successful policies on the other side are innumerable. And I don't know that everyone's gotten to that. That's where the feedback is really important.
And one last comment on that too. I think, you know, we probably all have had experience, my office certainly has, but every time you talk to a different person, they give you a different answer. And so I think that also depends on the person at the end of the other end of the phone line about how much in-depth they are going into looking in the plan and looking into the right codes. So I agree, it probably is maybe a difference in the communication as well as, you know, making sure the right codes and such are. I haven't personally had a significant issue with that in the past from my experience, but you know, I'm also not the patient who gets the bill at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering in terms of what types of communications happen within a plan in terms of the decisions that you make as a medical director around coverage and how that goes to member services and communicated to the physicians. How much of that is wires getting crossed as well?
Well, we do go through processes of plan review and design, but we can always get better at that. And, you know, I just got some great feedback on my formulary. We could really organize the categories a little bit better. And I think that there's no perfect way to do things, and I think we're all continuing to learn. I think there's 400 health plans are each figuring it out on their own. And maybe the more guidance we get from some central regulatory authority, the federal government to the state, the better. But I think that it's very, very difficult to cover everything at the level of literacy, clarity, and availability that you need. I think every health plan makes good faith efforts to allow their members to understand what services are available, but recognize that that's an imperfect but still improving process.
Hi, Kimberly Leonard, healthcare reporter with U.S. News and World Report. A couple of questions. First of all, do we have a sense as to how many women are affected by this or what percentage? I'm not sure if that's in the report. And also, I was wondering whether grandfathered plans played a role in all of this.
We don't have the numbers of women, but I can say again that many of the largest carriers, most of the largest carriers in the country are included in the study, so it's large numbers of women's, but I couldn't give you a specific number. And grandfather plans are not included because we asked them for their coverage policies for all new plans. So the grandfather plans are not, didn't skew the results in any way.
Yeah, and I would just add that one of the things we learned is that because this is a very common, because contraception is so common, that most of the plans make coverage decisions across all their lines of business, so it happens at the national level. It's not like we're doing this in Indiana, this in California, and this in Texas. Right. And it's just so it's, yeah, and we don't have the number of women, unfortunately. I'd like to take a question over on this side, in the back there. Yeah.
Yes, I'm Jane Wishner. I'm with the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute, and I wanted to follow up on the point you were just making about similarities across plans and across markets, and ask a couple of questions about that. It sounds like, in looking at your methodology, that you did find that contraceptive coverage was not used to kind of vary benefit design across different markets. And that's, so that was one question. The second is the differences between employer-sponsored insurance and the marketplace plans, and particularly the whole issue of transparency in the marketplaces and the health insurance exchanges. So when an individual is choosing a plan, it seems that some of the issues you've identified are also relevant to other challenges in terms of transparency of who's in network as a provider, what's in the formulary. Did you find any differences between the employer plans, which for many employees, for many women, may not be something they choose? It's a question of what's covered. But when you're going about during open enrollment choosing a plan, is there better access to information in terms of contraceptive coverage?
So as Elena said, we found that carriers really set these policies at the national level and didn't vary them either by group market, small market, individual market. They created them and they were good for basically in all regions that they offer coverage and for all plans. And that was surprising to us. We thought that they might vary it depending, but it kind of makes sense in that the requirement is the same for all of those markets under the ACA. So we didn't see any difference. For the transparency, I think it's equally hard for all policyholders to figure out what their coverage is. Many of the documents are the same for group coverage as for individual coverage. Maybe some of the marketplaces might be helping with some of the transparency, but we didn't see that.
Did you want to add something?
So in filing documents for New York and New Jersey, which I had done, you have to define a benefit set around a product type and offer that, and you can offer that same product type in the employer market and in the individual market, and it's identical. And then there's a level of consistency if you're going to have a medical policy and a claims policy to be fairly consistent in that dimension, because if you want to do it differently, you have to explain why you'll do it differently. So even though I critique the medical policies that plans may have, they at least aspire to be internally consistent and apply to all lines of business around a given health plan.
Okay. We had another question here and then over there.
Rashma Patel at George Mason University School of Public Policy. So I was really interested in when you said that long-acting reversible contraceptives had the largest impact after the Affordable Care Act, specifically IUDs. There aren't a ton of hormonal options, two right now, and Mirena and Skyla, and then one Lyletta that was just FDA approved. Do you see any challenges for new IUDs that are FDA approved, like Lyletta, getting covered under health plans now post Affordable Care Act when they're already Mirena and Skyla already covered? Do you have any comments on that?
I actually do expect that there's going to be issues. I think that we, some of the research has shown that they're already, saying coverage for either the Mirena or the Skyla. So those are two hormonal methods and that already exists. So adding a third hormonal method for an IUD, I think, is going to be very similar. There's always, that a lot of just came on the market. And so there's always going to be a little bit of time period before it's going to be covered by a lot of insurances. So there's already kind of that transition. But I would not be surprised if that coverage is going to be delayed significantly.
In the middle there. I'm sorry, you've had your hand up in the middle. Yeah, in the middle aisle. Yes, she's trying really hard. Yeah. I see you.
Hi, Elena. Gwen Mees with Bayer Healthcare. So I just want to add my sentiments and thank you for this important research to Kaiser. My questions, you started out in referring to how insurance plans were tackling new preventive services and said that's new. So I'm just curious, do you have a sense if there's the same variability for the other preventive services that have been added as there is for contraception? So I'm just curious about that. I know that's not what this study was intended to do. And sort of a second part, does the insurance industry at large, do they discuss the contraceptive coverage topic? Do you anticipate they would or would not take a public position on that?
Well, let me answer the second question first. I've gone to many national meetings, and I don't think I've attended a forum where it was discussed across plans what we might coverage. Not infrequently in these debates and discussions, there's conflict of trade agreements. I think that's misguided. I think we're in the wrong trade if we have a conflict to talk about what's good for our patients, but that's another story. So I would say, generally speaking, health plans do not have a discussion about this particular type of subject, although they may. To answer the first question, we do know that there's tremendous variation in implementation around preventive services. The American Lung Association came out last week with a report studying coverage for smoking cessation medications. And so there are 7 FDA-approved medications, and not unlike our own study, all are, should be covered according to the Preventive Services Task Force. So there's another example where there's tremendous variation, all right? And is there an explanation for that? I'd love to see it.
I'd like to add, if I may. So as I mentioned, we have a report coming out in 2 weeks about the contraceptive coverage provision, but we have a companion report that looks across plans at a range of women's services and whether plans are complying with not only the preventive services, but other services that are important to women that the Affordable Care Act requires, like maternity care. And unfortunately, we found violations across the board, pretty much. In the Well Woman visit, we actually found some limitations in the plan documents, maternity care problems. So we did find a number of violations.
Question, Susan. We need to, in the middle.
Thank you so much. I'm Susan Fogel with National Health Law Program. And we were very excited to have sponsored the California's bill along with the California Family Health Council. And you know, we took to heart the IOM report, and our slogan basically was all means all. It's a very simple message. And we found in California, I was really, you know, happy to see the your findings and how it affirmed the much less rigorous research that we did. But we found tiering, even though it is no common sense. We found, even though tiering makes no sense when you say no cost sharing, what we found was one or two plans, no co-payment, but you had to meet your deductible first. Mm-hmm. So they reinterpreted what no cost sharing means. Lots of prior authorization, lots of failure to cover, but also a lot of step therapy. And as you were pointing out, Gretchen, and fail, meaning what? You got sick, you had an allergic reaction, or you got pregnant, and then you could get a ring, I guess, as a postpartum method. But one of the questions that I did have was, we found that not everything was covered as a pharmacy benefit, yeah, but perhaps as a medical benefit. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you found that, and as Dr. Anson was pointing out, just to add to less and less transparency, obviously women would look at the formulary if that they knew how to find it. And did you find anything's hidden in that way?
Definitely. Most commonly, the LARCs were not on the formularies. They were considered a medical service because they're provided by the doctor. And so oftentimes, but not always, oftentimes those weren't on the formulary and they were part of a medical service. Certainly sterilization, the procedure, as well as the ancillary services are considered medical. And so that's why we had so much difficulty finding out about sterilization. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah.
But generally speaking, it would be my preference to have something on the pharmacy benefit rather than the medical benefit, because all too often there's a markup as whatever contract the doctor may have. There's maybe a markup on the procedure, on the implantable device, so we can get it cheaper through our pharmacy. So if that's the way to get it, then my goal is to make it fully available, create no barriers. But it certainly, if someone chooses to get it from my pharmacy, I'm delighted because it just saved $100.
But then they'd have to make two visits.
Right. Agreed.
Right? I mean, so it would work for the plan, it works, but in terms of
right.
for a woman, she would have to go to the pharmacy and get that.
Mm-hmm. And you'd have to pay for two visits as the plan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm interested in lowering the barriers. Sometimes the cost difference is more substantial than $100.
Yeah, we have a question over there. Yeah.
Hi, Allison Stevens with Women's eNews. My question is for Gretchen. I'm wondering if you have any sense of our data on whether women of color are experiencing limitations or cost sharing more so than other women, and also just what the implications of this variation are for women of color.
Well, I would certainly invite anyone on the panel to answer. I don't know that we have, you know, specific data, but obviously I think that we know across the board women of color experience disparities at a greater rate. And so I would expect that that would be true for implementing this benefit as well. And I think that, you know, the impact on women of color is it really advances women's health and lives in a number of ways and helps their bottom line, helps their family's health, helps their ability to, you know, participate equally in society in terms of finishing their careers and finishing their education and furthering their career. So I think that's generally true for everyone.
Yeah, we weren't able to, I mean, we couldn't tell what the members look like for the plan. So, you know, this is an issue that cuts across for all women, so. Question over there.
Hi there, I'm Rachel Soupe with Reproductive Health Technologies Project. My question is for Lori. I was wondering if you could clarify, when you were talking about Plan B and generic EC pills, did you mean they were covered if the woman had a prescription or if she was purchasing them OTC and then submitting them for reimbursement? And as a follow-up to everyone, I was wondering if you had any more details you could share about insurance coverage of OTC EC products. I know the HRSA language says as prescribed by so-and-so, but I would argue that that can be interpreted broadly. So any information you have on that would be great.
So in the report for plan, I assume you're talking about in our findings, not what I was talking about for the California law. So for our findings, that is with the prescription. We do have some information in the report about plans policies for over-the-counter, and those vary from, you know, they're different from what I presented for the coverage.
And then I think for your general question in terms of ECs now, you know, the effect now that they've gone OTC, at least for Plan B, you know, I've heard varying things also from, I think, insurance plans about whether they need prescription or if it's OTC, then, you know, they're not going to cover it. It depends on the insurance plan. So as a general rule, I continue to write prescriptions for patients.
Right, and there's no requirement that it be covered unless, I mean, as much as we know that it would be good practice. Some of the plans, one of the plans actually had a system where at the pharmacy, you want to talk about that example? That was interesting.
Sure, so they had a form where, where if a woman went to the pharmacy and picked up something over the counter, they had an actual form where they could then ask for reimbursement after the fact.
So. I like it. I like it.
You like it? Yeah. Question over there, yeah.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Davison of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I was wondering, particularly to Gretchen and Lori, and it wasn't part of your study, but I was wondering if you had experienced women experiencing the barrier of basically only getting their contraceptive covered if they had mail order prescriptions. That was something that we'd heard about in the news, and I didn't know if either you've sort of seen it on the ground or if in your research, like of the plan documents, that was something that you'd come across.
We didn't come across that.
We've heard some reports of problems with the mail order in our Cover Her hotline, so I think it is affecting some women, but I don't know how widespread it is, but it's certainly come up.
Good morning. Julie Gunnan with the Center for Reproductive Rights. I think this question is primarily for Gretchen. I know that the guidance under the ACA is fairly vague right now, but I guess I'm wondering where maybe you guys see the line between reasonable medical management and noncompliance with the law. I know that we're not at the point like where California's going, but if a plan only does cover one implant or one IUD, as was found, where's the tipping point between, well, there's that method's available versus, or do you think that everything should be covered under the ACA the way you read it now?
No, I think the guidance is clear that if you know, if there are some reasonable medical management techniques, then there has to be a waiver process. So if they cover one version, but a woman needs a different method or a different, you know, the generic versus the brand, she should be able to get that. And the problem is, as the report found, plans just don't have that waiver process. So actually, I think but I think that the California law is really a clarification of what the guidance is and spells it out, so there's no doubt. And I think that I wouldn't define the California law as a step further. I would just say it's a clarification of what the federal guidance is.
Okay, we had a question.
Thanks, Betsy Wien with the American Congress of OBGYNs. And I just had a question of whether you found there was an upper age limit cutoff. We had heard about a year ago that plans were cutting off around 44, 45, even though there are some older women who are still fertile and are at risk of pregnancy. And whether either Gretchen, you've heard this on your hotline, or whether you saw evidence that there are clinical policy guidelines at the insurers that don't follow our guidelines.
We didn't find that.
We have found that, yes.
I had not heard that. Other questions? No? Well, actually, we are right on time. So
wow.
There aren't
no further questions, I would like to thank everyone for really a really interesting and far-reaching discussion. Thank you to the audience, and thank you to our really spectacular panelists. Thank you.